This is Larry Yaffo on behalf of the Oral History Committee of SABRE. It's March 27th, 1992. I'm visiting with Bill Lorman, who pitched for the New York Giants and other National League clubs over a 10-year period spanning 1934 to 1944. The Brooklyn Dodgers, the Cardinals, and the Cincinnati Reds. Bill has a lovely home here in New Paltz, New York. A beautiful blue outlook on a mountain, on mountain scenery outside. And we're sitting here in the living room, and we're going to go back in time to originally to Brooklyn, New York, back in May 1913. So what we're looking for here is you were born on May 22nd.
May 22nd.
What part of Brooklyn, Bill?
Flatbush.
Yeah, you can speak, you know, a little, it's on,
oh, I didn't realize it was
sure.
On.
The Flatbush, and you want to describe the family about that time?
I had an older sister, 4 years older than I, and we lived in Flatbush on East 31st Street.
It was that Crown Heights or East Flatbush or Flatbush proper?
I was East Flatbush, I would say, yes.
And did you go to a public school there? And
public school, number 181.
Uh-huh.
And I was only 2 blocks from where I lived, and not too far from Holy Cross Cemetery.
Uh-huh. What was the size of your family then? Were you the firstborn?
I was the secondborn. My sister was 4 years older than I. Her name was Mildred. She's still living. And then later on, I had a sister by the name of Winifred, who was 3 years younger than I.
Uh-huh.
We lived at East 31st Street until about, I guess about 1927, I guess, and then we moved to East 48th Street.
Yeah.
East of Holy Cross Cemetery.
Uh-huh.
Near Utica Church.
Okay. What was your dad's occupation?
My dad worked for a Borden's Mill Company.
Uh-huh.
He was a night supervisor at Fort Hamilton area in Brooklyn. He used to work nights. He was supervisor of the plant.
Didn't get to see him that often, I imagine.
No, not too much, because
he was resting during the day.
Yeah, he was resting most of the time during the day.
Did he have any athletic talent of any kind? Do you remember?
Not really. Not really. But he was interested in baseball.
Yeah.
He really was, because he used to take me to Ebbets Field.
Yeah.
And this was back in the 20s.
Oh, sure.
And Babe Herman was there, and Zach Wheat, and Desi Vance.
Jacques Fournier.
Yeah. Robin Ramville was playing there.
Hank DeBerry and Dave Bancroft.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know,
Giga Stats.
Yeah. Those were fun days. I guess, of course, the club usually was a 6th, 7th, or 8th place team.
They were down there.
But we used to beat the Giants once in a while. It was big doings, wasn't it, in Brooklyn?
Oh, that was a real rival.
Sunday when you could... I remember sitting in the upper stands there at Ebbets Field about the time you're talking about and seeing Mel Ott, who must have been about 19 years old, and trotting out to his right field position. I always felt, said to myself, geez, that's as far as I want to go in the world. he would flip the sunglasses down, and of course, usually hit a home run or two there. He loved to hit in that park. So when you were a kid in school, were there people that were important to you? A lot of people have an important teacher or an important coach or...
Not in school, really, mm-hmm. But there was a... There was a coach who was starting up a minor league team, not a minor league team, a Sandlot team in Brooklyn. And somehow he got in touch with me, I don't know how. And we had a team called the Falcons.
So that must have been Harold Seymour.
Harold Seymour, Cy Seymour, right.
Well, Cy is very well known to all of the people at Cooperstown and at Sabre because he... As a matter of fact, he received an award recently for some of the work he's contributed.
Isn't that great?
And Cy certainly singled you out in conversations that I had with him and that he had with Herb as one of the people that he felt had the talent and that he enjoyed, you know, managing as a Sandlot ball player.
He thought I had a chance to make it in baseball, and that's all I wanted to do was play ball, and that was my ambition, was to be a Major League Baseball player.
Was that from, you know, hanging out with other kids and playing stickball or
playing
football?
Stickball and handball, that you throw the ball and hit it with your fist. In the schoolyard at 181, and that's really how I started to play ball.
Now, you went to school with at Tilden High School.
No.
Didn't you?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I didn't go to Tilden. I went to Alexander Hamilton High School. I didn't finish.
My mistake.
You went to high school.
Now, it seemed to me that Hamilton played their games at a place called Hawthorne Field. Was that correct?
I believe so, yes.
And they had a very short right field fence. And if you hit the ball over the fence, close to the foul line, it was only a double. Is that correct, Bill?
I believe it is, yes. Yeah. Right.
And it was really shaped for more for football or soccer than baseball, although I know that Hamilton played there because I used to see the Erasmus Hall team play there.
Yeah.
And I was amazed at one game, a catcher by the name of Russo, hit a ball over the left field fence, which must have been over 400 feet. It was such a long shot. I remember seeing a game when he had done that at that field.
I didn't pitch much in high school.
I quit
high school to go to work,
And
I went to work in Wall Street.
So most of your pitching was done, ball playing was at the parade grounds. Then.
Parade grounds in Brooklyn and also out in Queens, Long Island.
Yeah.
Later on in semi-pro ball.
Was that the Queens Alliance or?
The Astoria Red Sox.
Were there any of those ball players that you played with there? I know about your parade grounds background because I think we'll go on the record here with the fact that there is a Parade Grounds Alumni Association, which you're part of.
Right.
And we get together every so often, fellows who played ball over 50 years ago, and have a lot of fun doing it. Telling a lot of lies and stories that get better every time they're told. But how about the fellows that you played ball with in the Queens area? Did any of them aspire to the major leagues or get to the major leagues?
Yeah, there was, mostly from the parade ground.
Right.
One was Harry Eisenstadt.
Yes.
And second baseman was with the Cardinals.
George Fallon.
George Fallon.
Yeah.
And then there was a pitcher from Long Island by the name of Harborough, who was up for a while. Some of the teams out there for Tony Cusinello's brother when
Al Cusinello
came up from there about that time.
He wound up being a teammate of yours, I think, for a brief time with the Giants, didn't he?
No, I don't think. Maybe he did. Maybe he was there.
Yeah, see, I think he was, I'm not sure whether it was in the late 30s or early 40s. But you had, was Cy your only manager at the parade grounds?
Was my only manager at the parade grounds, and he was the one who thought I had a chance to make it. Mm-hmm. And he wrote to the Branch Rickey, the Cardinals, to ask if I could have a tryout with the Rochester team.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did in, I guess, probably 1932. I went over and pitched batting practice, and they told me...
Was this in Rochester?
No, this was in Newark.
In Newark, yeah.
And I pitched batting practice, and Billy Southwick was the manager. And he told me to go home and put a little weight on and come back again.
Yeah, I always remember you as a skinny kid when you were pitching.
I was tall and lanky, but skinny.
Now, when did you first get touched by somebody who wanted you to sign up and play professionally? I mean, obviously Southworth, you know, saw you work out and sent you back to get some more meat on the bones.
Mm-hmm.
But when were you actually approached?
In 1933, Cy again got in touch with Prince Ricky.
Yeah.
And they sent me a contract to come to spring training with the Rochester Red Wings in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Right.
In fact, so I went down to spring training. He even went down to spring training.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And that was the same. That was the year that Johnny Myers was on his way up.
Uh-huh.
He just had gotten out of college.
Yeah, well, that would be interesting, you know, as we try to trace your teams that you played on in the minors and the players that were teammates of yours who later made it in the majors. You mentioned Myers as one.
Johnny Myers was one. Toporsa, he was there.
Yeah.
Florence, a catcher, big catcher by the name of Paul Florence.
Toporsa was still playing then.
He was still playing. Yeah. He was playing second
base. I know he had an eye problem.
Right. But this was in 33. Yeah. And let's see, who else? Well, I didn't make it with Rochester, and they sent me out to Springfield, Missouri. And I was there for a while, and then they sent me to Springfield, Illinois.
Was that your first trip away from home, the one to the training camp?
Yes, it was, really. Yeah. It really was my first trip.
How'd your folks react to that?
Well, they were all for it.
Yeah, your dad certainly was in your corner.
Yeah, yeah. He encouraged me. Yeah.
How about your mother?
Both.
Yeah.
She was, too. Yeah. I had a nice family. They were great parents.
Yeah, that's great that they were that supportive and makes it so much easier. Now, let's see, you went out to Springfield, Missouri, and then Springfield, Illinois.
Right. And the manager there at that time was Clay Hopper.
Uh-huh. That was the guy who eventually wound up in the Dodger system.
Right. Yeah. And he was an outfielder. And I used to pitch and play the outfield. To tell the truth, Hopper, he was a terrible outfielder. To be honest with you.
How was he as a manager?
He was good as a manager. He was a good hitter.
He was Jackie Robinson's manager of Montreal, I know.
Right. Yeah. And it was a close ball game. At the end of the last few innings, he would take himself out, and then I would go and play the outfield.
Uh-huh.
So between pitching and playing the outfield, I played in 73 ball games.
How did the team wind up?
Not too good. Yeah. Oh, I was traded then from Springfield, Illinois. I went to Keokuk, Iowa, in the same league.
Right.
The Cardinals were involved, and they must have had working agreements with at least four teams in that league.
Yeah. Yeah.
Van Tricky was practically running the whole team.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole league.
Well, that in those days, it wasn't unusual for a team, a major league team, to have two or three teams that they were sponsoring in the minor
league. That's true.
That's
right.
Why Judge Landis turned all those fellows loose. Yeah.
So I didn't have a very good year. In fact, I had a terrible year. I won 4 games and lost 13. In the last 2 weeks of the season, the club was broke. They couldn't pay us.
Oh, God.
So I had played all year long. I had to send a wire to my father to send me money to get home.
Oh,
and I took a bus from Iowa all the way home to Brooklyn. And so the next spring, I didn't know what to do because I had a terrible year. And I heard they were starting up a club in Hartford, Connecticut. That was the old
Eastern League.
Eastern League. And one of the manager there was Bill Henry, who was an old pitcher of the Giants.
Mm-hmm.
So they signed me. A contract. The season started off, and I won 4 games in a couple of weeks. And the first thing you know, I was with the Philadelphia Phillies.
Uh-huh.
So how do you figure it out?
Well, the Phillies signed you or bought you from Hartford?
On trial.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So and that was 1934.
That's what I had down here. Yeah. And
they had, of course, they were down in the bottom of the league, but they had some good hitters.
I was looking at some of these names here. Dolph Camilli, I don't know if he played
first base. Lou Chiozza, Dick Bartel, Bucky Wallace was the third baseman.
Right. Ethan
Allen was there. Moore, Gene Mutton.
I think it was Johnny Moore.
Johnny Moore.
Now, your manager there was Jimmy Wilson, right?
Right.
And
that's right.
Well, I'd like to go back a bit now.
Yeah.
In the minor leagues, what was your out pitch? Your fastball low or your curveball? I always thought of you as a low ball
pitcher. I was a low ball pitcher. Yeah.
But did you when you were, you know, had to come in with it, was it the fastball or the curve?
That was my best pitch then, was my fastball.
Was that the type of sinking fastball, Bill, or not? Or maybe
that,
not?
That came later.
Yeah.
I don't know how I came up with that slider.
Yeah.
And they tell me I'm one of the first, if not the first, to throw the slider in the big league.
That's now, interesting.
I don't know.
Yeah.
At least that's what Hal Schumacher tells me and Dick Bartel. And it was a natural slider,
right.
So that came later. But in the minors, it was in the lower leagues. It was fastball.
Okay, still in the minor leagues.
Yeah.
Were there players that you played with at that time who you were very impressed with, who you thought were going to make it in a big way to the majors? I'm speaking of your time with Hartford or with Keokuk or Springfield.
I can't remember too much. Too many players at that time. One sticks out in my mind, and that he was a catcher, and his son was went up to the Yankees. He was killed in a plane crash.
Thurman Munson. Oh, his
he caught me in Springfield, Illinois.
Oh, was this Munson did? No, or his father.
His father. His name was Thurman too.
Yeah,
Thurman Munson.
It's interesting. That's an oddity.
He was a little. He wasn't too tall. He was short and stocky and a redhead. Mm-hmm. But his name was Thurman Munson too. He caught me in Springfield, Illinois.
How about? Your other managers. Now you mentioned Clay Harper. What were some of your other minor league managers that depressed you? How'd you rate them?
Guy Sturdy. Mm-hmm. He managed me in Baltimore Orioles.
Mm-hmm.
And Bucky Krause, mm-hmm. the old catcher. That's about all I can remember now because they managed when I was in Baltimore.
Of all of those people, I mean, did any one of the two or three that you mentioned, were they particularly good for you, helpful to you, or fostering
your career? Well, Bucky was very helpful to me because he was a catcher.
Yeah.
And I think he was very helpful to me.
Yeah.
As I said, before I was sold to the Giants.
Well, now we're up to you stay with the Phillies. Obviously, you didn't stay with them after 34.
No, I was only with them a short time.
Yeah.
And then my contract was assigned to
Baltimore
Orioles.
Uh-huh.
And that was about the July, probably.
Is that where Guy Sturdy was your manager?
Right. He was manager then. Uh-huh. John Ogden was the general manager. And the owner of the club was old Mrs. Jack Dunn.
Oh, yes. He was a famous figure in Baltimore
baseball. He was the one who founded Babe Ruth.
Yes, that's what I understand.
Yeah.
I hear that that new ballpark, by the way, must be a wonderful place to play ball. And,
well, the one I played in was a wooden.
Yeah.
It was a wooden ballpark before the memorial.
Yeah.
And that burned down years after, I guess.
Now, of all these cities you mentioned, did you have any favorites? What was it like, for example, were you boarding in a boarding house or something when you went to Keokuk or Springfield?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, sleeping with four or five other guys?
There was three or four other fellows in the boarding house. Meal money then was $1 a day.
Now, this is what we want on here.
$1 a day meal money, and my salary was $75 a month.
Uh-huh.
And I had to pay my own room and board out of that.
A lot of Coca-Colas, a lot of hot dogs.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah.
But things were cheap then, you know?
But you didn't have to drive the bus. You had to ride on it.
No.
It was all bus travel.
Oh, gosh, that was really something to travel on those buses because you ride all night long.
Yeah.
I can remember one day, we were riding, I don't know where we were going from, but it was in the middle of the night and the bus broke down, and there we sat. So we had to wait and wait and wait, and they usually had a big rack on top of the bus where they put all the uniforms in the bags and so on,
yeah.
And another fellow and myself went up on top of the bus and got under the canvas to sleep. And the first you know, they had fixed the bus and started up, and there we were up on top of the bus.
Oh, my. What was the longest bus ride that you had to take between fields, just approximately? About a day's ride?
Day's ride, overnight, day's ride, because you had to play in the next town.
And I would imagine the buses were as comfortable as those big luxury liners.
Oh, God,
they were
just
today.
Like a school bus.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I got to tell you a story. I was in Keokuk, Iowa, and we played a night game on Friday night. And then we had an off day Saturday, and then we had to play a doubleheader Sunday in Quincy, Illinois. Well, this first baseman had a Model A coupe, and three of us decided to leave midnight Friday night and go to the 1933 World's Fair in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
We started off at midnight after the game. We rode all night long. We couldn't go more than 35 miles an hour, I'm sure. We got to the World's Fair on Saturday morning at 9 o'clock in the morning. Went to the fair all day long. Left there at 12 o'clock Saturday night. Drove all night coming back to get to Quincy, Illinois. And those two fellas I drove with had to play doubleheader that day.
Oh, my God.
So I had to do that
you
today.
You didn't have to pitch that
I didn't day. Have to pitch. I was lucky. If I did that today, it would kill me.
Tell me about the cities, of all of the cities that you're in, a minor league, if we can just dwell on the minor league cities, which was your favorite? I would assume it's Baltimore, but I don't know.
Baltimore was a very nice city. Of course, that was a big city at that time.
Yeah.
And in the smaller minor leagues, like the 303 I league, the towns were small. I think Keokuk was only, I think the population was 15,000 people.
But Baltimore was a very colorful city.
It was.
And
it was
a lot of history.
Very
there.
Clean. At that time, it was very clean. And they had streets and houses of white marble steps that the people would go out and scrub these marbles down every day and just shine. But that was a great city. I liked Baltimore. The only thing was very hot. It was very hot in the summertime.
I was down there once when the major leagues had their convention in Baltimore.
Oh, yes.
They had the meetings there. And I saw our mutual friend George Fallon there at the Lord Baltimore Hotel.
Uh-huh.
And he and Al Lopez, who was then managing, I forget whether he was managing the Indians then or one of the other, or the White Sox, I don't remember. And he and Jake Flowers were talking, and George and I joined them, and they were talking about a game in 1930 when Dazzy Vance almost pitched the Dodgers to the National League Championship. It was very enjoyable.
I used to watch him pitch.
Yeah. He was a colorful.
Oh, he was a great
that
pitcher.
Flapping sleeve.
Yeah. Big man. Yeah. Big man.
I thought it was rather sad. I went to a World Series game at Ebbets Field, and I saw Mungo and Dazzy Vance sitting side by side behind the Brooklyn dugout in one of the owner's boxes. And I couldn't help but think, geez, these fellows are looking at the Dodgers that had won the National League Championship, and they pitched their arms off for sixth and seventh place teams. It was so sad, you know.
Yeah.
I thought it's somebody who'd seen him play. All right, let's get into Baltimore now. Bill, when did you get married, by the way? I mean, I know that you...
I married in 1935.
So you actually were married just about the time that you started pitching for Baltimore.
A year later. Right.
Maybe a year later.
Yeah.
And you...
My wife originally was from New Paltz here. She lived right across the way from the house.
Is that right?
Uh-huh. Since then, the house burned down. But this was part of her father's farm.
Uh-huh.
So she was born and brought up here in New Paltz.
But so she had not seen you actually as you were growing up in Brooklyn?
No,
right?
No.
Right. And in Baltimore, did you have your own place or did you rent down there?
Rented an apartment.
Uh-huh.
And you never had any trouble renting. There always seemed to be some place to renting in it for the season.
Yeah, not like it is in most of these areas today.
Yeah, that's right.
Kind of expensive. How about some of your teammates? Was Harry Gumbert there when you were there? Or
Harry Gumbert was there. Cliff Melton was there. Eddie Mayo.
He later went up to Detroit.
High Vandenberg.
That I was trying to think of his name.
High Vandenberg and I were sold together to the Giants.
That's
and the ballpark was a very small ballpark. It was a real bandbox.
Well, of all the International League parks, which is the one that you, you know, have preferred to pitch in? And there were a lot of them. I mean, Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse.
Newark, yeah.
How was it pitching up in Montreal and Toronto? Were those good ballparks to pitch
Toronto
in?
Was a nice ballpark. Yeah. It was. Montreal was good, too.
Toronto was right on the lakefront, wasn't it, the ballpark there?
And that was a good ball town. And it is now, too. Oh, where they draw now.
Oh, I would think so. That's a fabulous complex they have up there now.
Yeah.
How about this guy, Eric Tipton, the outfielder? Was he at Toronto? Was he in the International League?
He was in the International League, yes.
Was he a pretty good ball player? The reason I'm asking the question is because I see he was your teammate someplace here. I think it was with Cincinnati, the short time that you...
Yeah, very short time I was there. The players that stand out in my mind from the minor leagues in the International League was the Newark team. Mm-hmm. Oh, they
probably could have beaten.
They had a major league ball club.
Yeah, I remember those teams. They were great.
They had Charlie Keller.
Yeah.
Buddy Rosa. Hershberger. Babe Dahlgren. Bob Seeds. They had a great ball club. Oh, and their pitchers. Spud Chandler.
Adley Donald.
Russo.
They had a great fielding shortstop, too, by the name of Nolan Richardson.
Richardson. He was a good ball player.
That Newark team could probably have competed in either the American or the
They could have.
League.
They really could. Because most of them went up, a lot of them went up within the next year or two.
I interviewed Buddy Hassett for this oral history committee not too long ago, and he claimed that Charlie Keller, if they had not tried to alter his style to make him pull the ball because of the right field fence, right field area, which was short in the Yankee Stadium, that he would have been a Hall of Famer.
I think
because his natural strength was to hit the ball
straight away
or where it was pitched.
That's right.
And he was a great natural athlete. And of course, his career was cut short by a bad chronic back problem.
Yes.
He must have been a
good hitter.
And now, let's see, you had, you were at Baltimore for a couple of years, 35, 36. You were sold to the Giants when? Was it 37 or 36?
1937. Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, Bill Terry was the manager, right?
Bill Terry was the manager, and he was the one who scouted me, so he said.
Yeah.
When a game that I pitched at Jersey City, and I had a good year that year. I won 20 games for the Orioles.
Baltimore,
37.
And tell me, it must have been quite a thrill for you, pitching in the pitching at Polo Grounds when you came up to the Giants. Did you have the whole family out there?
No, nobody was there, really. When I was with Baltimore, we were in the playoffs.
Yeah.
I had to stay with Baltimore. I couldn't go up to the Giants until the season was over.
Yeah.
And when I did go up, I wasn't eligible to pitch in the World Series.
Oh, I see.
But I did pitch one of a crucial game
when
they were fighting for the pennant the last week or two of the season.
Uh-huh.
And Hubble pitched the first game, and I pitched the second game. Uh-huh. Of course, that was a great feeling. I'll tell you that.
I'm sure
it really was.
And well, how about your dad? Now, did he get out to see you play when you got to New York?
Yes, he used to come quite often to Brooklyn to Polo Grounds.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he was a real ball fan.
It was kind of nice there when we could go to either the Polo Grounds or Brooklyn to see the games.
I used to stay at my folks' house
when
I first went up to the Giants. My wife and I and my daughter would stay in Brooklyn and just take the subway right over to Polygram.
Well, I always thought those were fun excursions because, you know, your mother would pack a sandwich, at least for me, you know, when I was a teenager, go up there to see the games when the Dodgers would play at the Polo Ground. I get these sandwiches and paper and be absolutely flattened by the time you got to eat. Now, you went to the Giants over, you had 3 great years there. You were doing pretty well.
I was doing pretty well.
And that was probably the peak of your career.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And the peak of my career was in 42, really. 1942.
And, I'll throw out some of these names, the ball players. Bill Terry, now as a manager, you played for Bill. You also played briefly for Southworth. Was DeRocher involved in...
DeRocher when I was with Brooklyn.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That was a very short time, though, wasn't it?
And then McKechnie when I was with Cincinnati.
Uh-huh.
Mel Ott. When he became manager of the Giants.
How did you react to these fellows as far as being managers were concerned? I mean, did any one or two of them, you know...
I didn't like Terry. I didn't like Terry at all. He was tough,
mm-hmm.
especially on the young players.
Uh-huh. Disciplinarian? Yeah.
Yeah. He had great years with the Giants, won 3 or 4 pennants. A couple World Series, and the older players did a lot for him.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't say much to the older players, but he'd take it out on the young guys when things went tough.
Yeah, that's probably the way it was done to him when he was coming up.
I think he got a lot of it from McGraw.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah, and he McGraw didn't talk for a long time.
No. I can tell you a few things that happened that I didn't like. When we made a Western trip, we used to play 4 days in one town instead of three.
Right. Usually only 3 trips in those years.
Right. And we went into Pittsburgh for this 4 days, and we had a meeting in the clubhouse. Everybody was there. And this is my second year up. And he says to me, I'll pitch you in batting practice here. He says, you wouldn't be able to get anybody out here anyway. So to me, that's
a real downer, yeah.
Real downer. Instead of giving them guy a boost to set you down, but that's the way he was. That's the way I felt about him, anyway.
How about Mel Ott?
Mel Ott was very easy going.
Yeah.
I liked Mel Ott. In fact, I had my best year under Mel Ott.
Yeah.
Whether that had anything to do with it, I don't know.
Those were great Giant teams in those years. I was just throwing out some of these names: Travis Jackson,
Travis Jackson, yeah, right.
And Joe Moore.
I talked to Joe Moore last month.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Was he up here, or
no,
just called him in Texas?
I just felt like talking to him down in Texas.
He's still in Gauss?
He still lives in the same town. Yeah. Gauss, Texas. Right.
He was a rancher, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah.
Tall string bean, a guy, and what a ball player.
He was a good ball player. He really
good
was.
Arm, good outfielder,
yep.
And he get the hits for you.
Yeah, he was a good outfielder.
I think he was a leadoff man.
Yes, yes he was.
Then you had Hank Lieber there, who was another outfielder.
Yeah.
What was Dick Bartell like? I know
he was a scrapper.
Yeah.
he was a scrapper and full of pep, hollering all the time.
Yeah.
He was a good ball player.
Were you
good
on the team when he and Mungo rolled down the right field foul line? It was during an opening game. I don't know if it was an opening game, but it was the first game of a series between Brooklyn and the Giants, and Mungo, you know, came inside to him, and he bunted down the first baseline. The two of them collided and started.
I don't remember that.
Yeah,
that might have been the year before.
Dick was. He wrote a book on the 30s with...
He sent me a book.
Yeah.
I have the book.
And I thought it was very good.
Good.
I thought Norman Mack, who was the head of the Oral History Committee, I thought he did a great job in portraying the 1930s, the way Dick and he put that together. Burgess Whitehead was another infielder who was there when you were there.
Yes, he was. I tried calling Burgess here a month or so ago, and I couldn't get through. He had an unlisted number. I talked to Billy Jurgis about 2 months ago.
Billy's, is he in Florida?
He's in Florida, yeah.
Yeah. Those are familiar names.
Hubble, I roomed with Hubble for a couple of years.
What puzzled me, or what I got a kick out of, was Bartell and Jurgis. When Bartell was with the Giants and Phillies and Jurgis was with the Cubs, they were always at one of them.
They were scrapping all the time.
And then all of a sudden you wound up seeing the two of them playing side by side.
Isn't that something?
And on the Giants, there was another one. Dick and Johnny Burgess played high school baseball together.
Is that right?
In Alameda High School. They were the two of the stars of the team. But when Dick came to the Giants, Burgess went to the Phillies.
Yeah.
So they never got to play together on the big team. Jimmy Ripple, was he there? Was he on the team when you were there?
Yes, he was. And he was also with Montreal when I played in the minor leagues.
You mentioned trying to get to Whitehead. Is he still doing the peanut farming down there?
That I don't know. Yeah. I really don't know.
Johnny McCarthy, Sam Leslie. You know, if you think of any incidents involving these guys that would be...
Well, I can tell you a strange incident about Carl Hubble. I think you'll get a kick out of this. You know, when you're knocked out of the box in the Polo Grounds, the clubhouse is directly in center field. So you feel like you're on a trap door right on the mound because you had a long walk down there. Well, anyway, this particular day, I guess it was near the end of Hubble's career, they had hit 3 home runs off Hubble. And I was in the bullpen. They called me in. And when Hubble left the mound, instead of going directly towards center field, he was inching over towards right field where I was walking in from the bullpen.
Right.
And I kept looking, wondering what in the world he was doing, what he was coming over that way for. So we passed each other out in the middle of the outfield. And he didn't look at me, he was just looking down at the ground, and when he went by, he said, for Christ's sake, make him hit the ball on the ground. And he just went out. So that's what he was inching over for.
He had some remarkable string there. I think he won 16 straight games.
Over 2 years,
And I think it was Brooklyn that broke that string, too, and on a holiday.
I'll give you another strange story. I was with the Giants, and my friends in Brooklyn, whom I played ball with when I was a quick kid at the parade grounds and so on, they had a day for me.
I was out there that day.
Were you there that day?
Yes. Herb, I saw Herb sitting in the dugout. You were sitting at the other end of the dugout, and then they made a presentation to you.
Right. And they gave me some suitcases.
Yeah.
And when I was carrying them back to the dugout, some leather-lunged Brooklyn fan from behind the dugout said, "Hit the road, you bum, you."
Yes, that's the traditional greeting in Brooklyn. They were great fans, but...
God, they were great fans. They were.
But they were tough on... Although, I don't know, some players, like Stan Musial was a very popular player in Brooklyn, even though he used to beat them a lot. And I don't know, there were so many great players. I mean, a guy like Mel Ott and some of the National League stars in those years... I could never understand how people could boo them when they
But that's the type of fans they were. My wife was at a game one time, and somebody hit a home run, and this man up on the upper deck right along the rail, he had his jacket on the rail, and the jacket fell off and fell in this man's lap down below.
Oh, my God.
And the guy turned around and looked up, and he says, "Where's the pants?"
Oh, that's wonderful.
My wife told me that one.
How about some of the pitchers that you pitched with? Hal Schumacher.
He was a worker. He was a hard worker.
Up here in Dallasville,
New York. Yeah. I went up there a couple of years ago. They had a day there for him.
Uh-huh.
Little Falls, where the Mets had a team there, and they asked me to come up. Buddy Carr was there.
That's great.
That was nice. It was nice to go up and see him.
Now, you mentioned Hub. Do you have any other recollections of him? Because he's an immortal. He just passed away not too long ago.
He and I were very close friends. A strange thing happened in 1938. I had gone up to the Giants in 37, and this was spring training in 38. We went to Hot Springs, Arkansas for the Bears and to J.
just the pitchers and catchers to work out. And then spring training was going to be in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which is quite a ways from Hot Springs.
Yeah.
So Hubble had driven his car to Hot Springs. And then when we were going to break camp, for some reason, he went to Terry and wanted to know if I could ride with him in his car from Hot Springs, Arkansas, to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which I thought was quite a feather in my cap.
Oh,
it made me feel great to have Hubble ask if I could ride with him.
Oh, sure.
So from then on, we were very good friends. It took 2 days to drive to get there, so.
And you had, how about some of these other guys? Clydell Castleman.
Castleman, yeah. He had back trouble when I came up.
And Fred Fitzsimmons?
Freddie Fitzsimmons. Well, he was there when I went up for the World Series, and then he was traded to Brooklyn.
You remember when he pitched for the Giants, he could beat Brooklyn every time he came out to the mound.
Yeah.
He was a jinx to Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And
he was a funny guy. He was a good guy. Everybody liked him.
Frank Gabler, that was a character.
Yeah.
A lot of stories about him. And Dick Kaufman, didn't he pitch? Wasn't he a pitcher?
He was a relief pitcher, yes. He was.
Kaufman is the guy who broke Lefty Groves' winning streak.
Oh,
Groves
right?
won 16 games, and in a game against the St. Louis Browns, Kaufman beat Groves.
I didn't know that.
1-0.
Oh, I mean,
and he broke the string. And the reason he was particularly upset, Grove, of course, it didn't take much to upset him.
No.
And he ripped the clubhouse apart in Sportsman's Park that day because Al Simmons didn't play left field. And whoever substituted for Al Simmons that day let a ball get away from him, which had an effect on the game. And obviously they lost 1-0. And Grove was a pretty unhappy guy. But that was written up at the time. And Kaufman was a young pitcher then. And this is quite a thing for him. He was pitching for the Browns.
I remember pitching against Grove in spring training. And faced
Simmons. Was he still very fast?
Yes, he was. Yeah. He was fast, yes.
Because I always thought, you know, maybe after, by the time he got to the Red Sox, he had tapered off a little bit.
Well, he probably did, but he was still pretty fast. I remember pitching to Al Simmons, too, in an exhibition game in Baltimore Orioles Park. He was mad as heck. The park was so small, it was a bandbox.
Yeah.
And he was such a great hitter. And it just happened that he hit three little ground balls back to me to the pitcher's mound, and boy, he was cussing and swearing. He wanted to hit one out.
That's the best thing that could happen when you're a pitcher, right?
Yeah.
In that situation. And Bob Seeds went on to hit a lot of home runs in the minor leagues.
Yeah, he was a great hitter in the minor leagues. Incidentally, I would say 6 weeks ago, I had received a letter from Bob Seed's nephew.
Is that right?
He said he never knew him, but and he wanted to know one question he asked me, how come he was such a great hitter in the minors, but he wasn't such a good hitter in the majors?
Well, it's like asking why Jack Winsett won all those, was such a terrific hitter in the American Association.
That's
and,
right.
Couldn't do anything when he got up in the majors.
It's different in the majors than it is in the minors, that's for sure.
Well, the pitching is tougher. And
you have that good pitcher every day.
You know, they always say good pitching will get the job
done. That's right.
I'm looking at some of these other, Bucky Walters, at the time that you were with the Phils, he was a third baseman.
He was a third baseman, yes.
With a good arm.
Good arm. He had a good arm. Yeah, and a good sinker when he was a pitcher, too.
He certainly made it.
And a good, pretty good hitter for, you know, when he was pitching.
I had a conversation with Billy Werber, who said that he thought Walters was one of the finest pitchers he'd ever played.
Oh, yeah. Billy came with the Giants later.
Was Al Todd with the Phillies when you were there?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I can tell you a story about Al Todd and Dick Bartel.
Yeah.
Because I was only a kid going up.
Yeah, I imagine that Todd was one of the most combative guys imaginable. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
He was a big guy.
Yes.
And Bartel wasn't that big, but he was a scrapper.
Yeah.
And we were in Boston, and we stayed at the Copley Plaza. I had dinner with the two of them. And after dinner, they give you a little cup of salted mixed nuts.
Yeah.
And Todd kept eating his and eating his. And first thing you know, he had them all eaten.
Yeah.
And Dick Bartell hadn't touched his yet. Yeah. So Todd started to reach over and was eating Dick's too. He said, "You better quit that." He said, "I'll cut your hand."
Yeah.
So Todd reached again and Bartell went like that with the knife and cut his knuckle. Just enough to draw blood, not much. But he did it. I couldn't get over it. I couldn't know what's going on. I just came up to the majors.
It didn't take much to get Al Todd angry. And well, I remember he caught
He didn't get angry then at Bartell.
How about, let's see, you mentioned some of these other names. Manny Salvo. Cliff Melton must have been a pretty good pick.
Cliff Melton was
he
a
He had
good
a couple
pick.
Of very good years with the Giants.
First year up with the Giants, he won 20 games. Yeah, that's when they won the World Series. Well, played in the World Series, huh?
Ace Adams.
Yeah, he was a relief pitcher.
Ace is, he had, there were some other guys there, Fisher.
Rube
Fisher.
Rube Benton, and Fisher was there, Carpenter was there. That was later. Harry Feldman, yeah.
Was Mungo with the
Mungo
Giants when you were there?
Yeah, he was there. But he was a tough one, boy.
I imagine so.
Yeah.
He could write a book about Van Lingle, Mungo. Johnny Wittig.
Johnny Wittig was a pitcher.
Was he a teammate of yours in Baltimore?
He was a teammate of mine in Baltimore, yeah. See, Baltimore was an independently owned club, so they sold a lot of...
The Dunn family, yeah. Pete Williams, son of Joe Williams, the columnist who's in the process of writing a book. You want to tell me a little more about it?
Yeah, Pete called me and stopped up to get some information about Bill Terry. He asked me to ask questions. You're writing a book about Bill Terry.
It would be a life story of Terry or a career story?
Evidently.
Yeah. And how about, there was another writer that you had mentioned to me earlier, too.
Hubble.
There's somebody writing a life story of Carl.
Life story of Carl Hubble. His name is Todd Hubble.
Todd Hubble is
a distant relative of Carl's, who lives in the state of Washington, and he's writing a book. Uh-huh. So he called me on the phone, talked to me about a half hour, and then he's going to stop and see me. He wants to ask me some more questions. He's on his way up to Cooperstown.
We were also talking about the ball players' gloves today, and the difference in the ones that the boys have today as compared to what they used to play with. And you told me a great story about Billy Gerges, the infielder of the Giants.
Billy Gerges, when he was with the Giants, when he got a new glove, he would take the glove and cut the ends of the fingers off, maybe an inch and a half end of the fingers off, and then he'd sit in the clubhouse and sew it up again, so that when he had a glove, it was just like a motorman's glove, I would call it. Just a pocket, and that's all there was to it. He always felt that it helped him to control the ball more, where the ball didn't hit the end of the fingers and get away from him.
Now, you had, as a pitcher, you had several catchers. You must have had some favorites amongst them. Of all the guys that you pitched to, was there one or two that you thought were particular favorite?
Well, I would say Danning, Harry the Horse Danning, and
right.
Gus Mancuso.
Uh-huh.
Although I pitched to Hartnett.
Yeah.
when he was with the Giants, pitched to Lombardi. Uh-huh. When he was with the Giants.
Lombardi was some kind of hitter, wasn't he?
Oh, he was a good hitter. Yeah. His hands were so big, when he, the umpire gave him a new ball, instead of rubbing it up with two hands, he would take his thumb and go around the ball and rub the ball up that way.
I would hated to play third base or shortstop with Lombardi at bat.
He was a pull hitter and hit
tremendous
with power.
Tremendous power. How about some of these other fellows? Did you actually play with the Dodgers when Bordigeray was on the team, Frenchie Bordigeray?
I don't know.
I don't remember. You didn't have that much time with the Dodgers.
No, I wasn't very long.
You did, when you were at Cincinnati, that was very brief too, wasn't it?
That was brief too, yes.
But you had, that was part of that great Cincinnati team that had Frank McCormick.
Frank McCormick in first, Lonnie Fry.
Yeah, Fry and
Bill.
Bucky Walters. Was Derringer with the team at that time?
No. Derringer. Vandermeer. And incidentally, the last game that I pitched for Cincinnati, and I lost a high-scoring game, and who came in to relieve me was Nuxhall.
Joe Nuxhall, the announcer?
Yeah, and he was the youngest pitcher ever to pitch in the major leagues at that time.
That's correct, yeah.
What is it, 15 years old, I think he was?
Oh, he's a little older than that.
16?
I think he's 16, yeah.
Yeah, he relieved me, so I was on my way out. In fact, I left the next day. I quit then and went home the next day.
Augie Galland, was he?
He was with the Dodgers then. Yeah, he was quite an outfielder.
Yeah, he had
the Cubs. He had some great years with the Cubs. Yeah,
I'm looking at some of these names who were teammates. Do you think of anything that you might want to tell me about them? Of course, Gabby Hartnett must have been toward the end of his career at that point, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, when he came to the Giants. Yeah, that was the end of his career. And, some of the trades that I was involved in, I was involved in the Johnny Mize trade. I went from the Giants to the Cardinals for the Johnny Mize trade. Ken O'Day and myself. And then I came back to the Giants, and I was involved with the Dolph Camilli trade from Brooklyn to the Giants.
Oh,
and that's
right.
That's when I went to the Brooklyn.
That's right, yes.
He never reported to the Giants, so
he went
home.
Yeah. That was, well, he was about at the end of his career.
Right, yeah.
He had a rather tragic experience. His son, his younger brother. Was a boxer. And wanted to fight professionally, and did, and fought against Max Baer's brother, Buddy Baer. And I think he died as a result of an injury received in that fight.
That's right.
Dolph never went to a fight again.
No.
Never went to another prize fight. He was an amazing guy, Camilli. He was very, very strong,
wonderful,
great pair of hands, and you'd see him coming out of the hotel around 6:30 in the morning to go to Mass. He was very religious.
Very quiet. Yeah. He was a great guy.
Terrific ball player.
A good fielder.
Oh, yeah.
Good in club, man. Yeah. Also a good hitter.
Pee Wee Reese used to say the same thing about him he said about Hodges. He said the only reason he wears a glove, he says, is he doesn't want to embarrass his teammates. He's got these huge hands.
Yeah, he did have huge hands. Oh, yeah. Hodges had big hands,
too.
Oh.
Hodges was a big fellow. Fortunately, those big fellows are the nicest temperament, so.
It seems so, doesn't it?
They were very gentle guys. It's very hard to get them riled up.
Yeah.
The only time I ever remember seeing Camilli riled up was when, in the World Series of a game of 1941, Tommy Henrich, was on first base and got caught off first with a snap throw by Mickey Owen. And he tried to kick the ball out of Dolph's glove.
Uh-huh.
And he kicked Dolph a few times, and Dolph came after him. The umpire, of course, stepped in, and he never got to him, which was fortunate for Henrich. But Dolph was just tended to his business. And looking at some of these other names here, those guys at the Phillies, you mentioned Chuck Kline. How about that Don Hurst?
Don Hurst on first.
Tremendous football, tremendous hitter, Mexican pole hitter.
Yeah.
And this, you mentioned several of the others, Lou Chiozza.
Dick Martino, of course.
Were there any games that, you know, you could point to? Of course, you mentioned the one that you, the second part of a doubleheader that you won with Bill Terry, the Giants. Were there any other games that, you know, you would kind of zero in on? And,
well, yes, there's one sticks out in my mind, and I knew I'd never come close again. I had a no-hitter with one out in the ninth.
Uh-huh. Really? Against
the Polo Grounds, yeah. Against the Braves.
Uh-huh.
And Johnny Cooney pinched hit. And got a high bouncer over my head, which I couldn't reach, and the shortstop and second baseman couldn't reach. It just trickled through the infield.
Well, that must have been a great game.
It was a good game. Yeah. And he came the next day and apologized to me.
John was a gentleman. He was a gentleman.
Yeah. He was a gentleman. He says, after all, he says, that's what I was getting paid to do.
Yeah.
To hit. But I knew I'd never come close again. They only come once in a lifetime.
No, and all of the fates have to be on your side.
Yeah,
you know.
That's
luck
true.
Is such an important...
Although, look at Ryan. I don't know. He's out of the ordinary, I think.
Well, he's a remarkable
Isn't
guy.
Isn't he, though?
And I saw him pitch this past summer when I was visiting my son in Dallas, and he was fast. Frighteningly fast.
It's unbelievable he can throw that ball. I can tell you a funny story that happened in the minor leagues.
Please.
Baltimore Orioles. Excuse me. Used to have a barber come in the clubhouse before the game, and he'd cut the player's hair. Well, this one day he came in, and the shortstop, his name was Wilburn, he sat down in the barber's chair, yeah. And he said to Bill Sissel, he said, if I have all my hair shaved off, will you have all your shaved off? Yeah. Sissel thought he was kidding. He says, yeah. He said, if you do, I will. So Wilburn sat down, told the barber, take it off. And God, he shaved his head, just like a cue ball. Got up, and Sissel looked at him. He didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And he sat down. He had the same thing done. Their wives pretty near divorced him. Because they get out on the field and before the game in Baltimore, and they play the national anthem, they'd have to take their hats off out on the field.
I don't know whether you ever think this way, but you've read of certain people picking their all-star teams. If we went position by position, who would you think was the finest center fielder that you ever saw? Or played against or with?
I think, as a center fielder, one of the best I ever saw was Terry Moore, the Cardinals. He was a great center fielder.
He could do everything.
He could do everything. He could run, he could field, he could throw. And he'd make everything look easy.
Would you put Lloyd Wainer in his category?
Lloyd was a good fielder. He was a good center fielder, definitely, yes.
And how about, let's go into it with a couple of others. You want to name a couple of other outfielders who were contemporaries of yours that you thought were outstanding?
Oh, gosh. Well, JoJo Moore was a good outfielder. He was a good left fielder.
And how about, I mean, I know you...
Right field, Mel Ott. I would say Mel Ott was an outstanding outfielder.
He was a fine all-around ball player.
He was.
How about your infielders now? Would you go around, as far as the first baseman is concerned, of course you were a teammate of Terry's, but there may be others that impressed you.
Oh, let me see, first base. Well, Dolph Camilli was a great first baseman.
Yeah,
he had a good pair of hands, good feel.
Mm-hmm.
Shortstop, Travis Jackson. Lou Boudreau?
Yeah, Boudreau was a fine shortstop.
Third base, Pi Trainer. I remember him well.
Oh, he was a fantastic
third baseman.
Second base, we had a lot of good ones in that era.
Well, Frisch, it was hard to beat. Frisch, it was Gordon. Joe Gordon
was fantastic, you know. A fine career. And it's funny how we had a lot of University of Oregon players who played on our Eastern teams. Joe Gordon was one of them. He was a star with the University of Oregon. Dick Whitman, who played with the Dodgers, was a captain of the Oregon baseball team. And we had another one, you remember Gordon Slade, Oski Slade?
No,
was an infielder with the Brooklyn Dodgers around 1930-31.
Is that right?
Yeah. He was also an Oregon star. And I always...
Oki Vaughn was a great...
Oh, tremendous shortstop and a great hitter.
Yeah, he was one of the best.
He hit disc for distance, and he was
fast going down the line.
No, they asked President Nixon to name his all-time baseball team because he was quite a baseball fan.
Yeah.
When he got the shortstop, he picked Vaughn up. It surprised everybody. They thought he'd say Honus Wagner or somebody, you know, like that.
Yeah.
He said Vaughn was a classmate of mine in high school. at Fullerton, California, and he said he was one of the greatest athletes the school ever produced. He said, so I got to put him in there. He said he not only was a good baseball player, he was a heck of a football player. And I thought that was very interesting. And of course, you could never doubt him. I think in your time and my time, the three greatest outfielders to me were Willie Mays, who I put right up at the top of the list, and DiMaggio. And certainly, as far as the third outfielder is concerned, any one of them you could name. I mean, Stan Musial certainly would be no slouch.
Yeah.
Musial, to me, did one of the greatest things I've ever heard of for a ball player to do by hitting 5 home runs in a doubleheader at Sportsman Park against the New York Giants.
Is that right?
He hit 3 home runs in the first game and 2 home runs in the second game. And when he was coming out of the ballpark that night to meet his family, his oldest son met him and said, Daddy, they must have been throwing that ball right down the plate in the center of the plate for you. And he wasn't going to give his father any credit for hitting 5 home runs. He said, they must have been letting up on you. He couldn't believe it. But can you imagine that? Five home runs?
In two games.
And as a pitcher, you would appreciate the performance by Jim Tobin when he pitched for the Braves. As a pitcher, he hit 3 home runs in one ball game.
He was a good hitter. He was a good hitter.
A Braves field, that was a long shot. That left field wall was not like a Baker ball, you know.
That's right. No, that was a big park, and he was a good hitter. He used to pinch hit.
Yes, he did. Yeah. They had a lot of good hitters amongst pitchers in those years. Red Lucas was another one.
Schoolboy Rowe.
Oh, yeah. Well, Rowe was a great all-around athlete. He was a good golfer.
Farrell.
West Farrell.
Yeah, there were some good hitters.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting that you hear all the ball players being compared as far as who is the fastest pitcher of all time. I don't know how you can do that.
No, you can't.
Because
you really can't.
You talk to everybody, you get a different answer. I'm sure that Walter Johnson must have been an intimidating pitcher to face with his speed, although he had excellent control. But I've talked to guys who say, ball players who say, Joe DiMaggio said the fastest pitcher he ever faced, and he faced Feller and some of the others who were very fast, he said was Rex Barney in a World Series game. He said he threw pitches by me, he said that I didn't believe were possible.
I roomed with Rex when I was with the Dodgers, when he first came up.
He said that he's now the public address announcer.
From the Orioles, isn't he?
Yeah, the Orioles now.
Yeah.
But he said Barney could throw hard.
He could.
I thought he would say something like Feller.
I would say Feller myself.
And of course, people will tell you about Ryan being faster.
How about Koufax?
Babe Ruth said that he thought on a given day Lefty Rowe was the fastest pitcher he'd ever batted against.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine a lot of people would agree. Rowe must have been an intimidating pitcher.
Oh, gosh.
But I don't know, you know, if the game still has its hold on everybody.
It's a great game.
And the kids today, fortunately, with the advent of television, you know, it was very hard. When I was trying to explain to people when I was at the Brooklyn Hall of Fame, Brooklyn Dodger Hall of Fame inductions, that before television, we didn't even have radio announcers before, you know, Red Barber came to Brooklyn and broke down the entire New York broadcasting problem, because the Yankees, Giants, and Dodgers agreed they would never broadcast any games.
Yeah.
And Larry McPhail came to Brooklyn, he brought Red Barber with him, and that forced the Giants and Yankees to broadcast their games as well. But when you and I were growing up, we'd have to run down the corner candy store to get the latest edition of the Brooklyn Times or the Brooklyn Eagle to find out how the team was doing.
Yeah.
Because you could only get maybe a partial score. There were no, even on news broadcasts, you couldn't get the scores.
No.
You had to wait for the paper. And those newspaper men did great work. They would paint the, you know, the different pictures of the ballparks in words. And it got so that in later years, when you saw a game on television, Crosley Field or Sportsman's Park or Tiger Stadium, you almost felt you knew every corner of it from reading about it in the paper.
Right. Red Barber interviewed me in 1934 in Cincinnati.
Uh-huh.
He introduced me as the league's leading hitter. I'd been up twice and got one hit.
That's great. Well, his books are very interesting, how he broadcast the original games in Cincinnati when he was given a chance to do the games there.
Yeah.
McPhail had he broadcast the games from the upper deck, from a box in the upper deck, and of course there were no statisticians or anything. He kept his own scorecard. He had an engineer there. He said one of his first assignments, he wanted to have an interview with Charlie Grimm, who was managing the Cubs.
Yeah.
And he was really very nervous about having the approach him, because he had not done anything like this before. He'd just come out of, you know, broadcasting at a Southern college station in Florida. But he said Grimm was very nice to him, and he always appreciated that. He gave him a great interview, and he said it made him feel very comfortable, and it helped him when he was doing games afterwards.
Well, he was a likable man, wasn't he, Grimm?
Oh, yeah.
Very,
very, you know, he had this soft voice that I think he got more women interested in the games than they ever were before. A lot of the women liked to listen to his accounts, and he made fans out of many of them.
Yes.
Taught them how to keep score, how to keep a box score. Well, Bill, I don't know. I think we've just about covered everything. I there's nothing else that I have on my sheets here. Yeah, at the present time, just so we have it on the record, you're fully retired.
Fully retired.
And you have families in the immediate area here.
And also in Vermont and Massachusetts and Florida.
Besides your son, William Jr., how many
others? I have a daughter.
Uh-huh.
And I have three grandchildren and two great-grandchildren.
Well, I know one grandchild is living in Wisconsin, from what you told me.
She's a granddaughter.
She's a granddaughter.
And she's a doctor,
uh-huh.
M.D.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And where is your other daughters?
My one daughter lives 6 months in Florida, uh-huh. and 6 months in Vermont.
Uh-huh.
And I have one granddaughter in Burlington, Vermont, one over in Kingston, Massachusetts, and the other one in Madison, Wisconsin. And two great-grandsons in Madison, in Kingston, Massachusetts.
Uh-huh. Well, on behalf of the Oral History Group, I want to thank you very much for your time and for sharing some of your memories and telling us about yourself. And I'm going to pass this tape on to Norman Macht, who is the chairman of the Oral History Committee, and I'm sure he'll send it on to Cooperstown, where you'll be on file, Bill, in case anybody wants to know anything about Bill Lorman and life in the 1934 to 1944. So this is Larry Affa for the Oral History Committee signing off. Thank you.